Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Reese Sheridan. On today's show, we discuss how cities can create the conditions for designers to thrive within.
Many designers bought many magazines to know what was happening outside Portugal, trying to copy, I would say, that style. But now there's a whole generation that actually values what's unique here.
We visit three very different cities on three continents that are all keen to kickstart their credentials as design hubs. Mexico City, Porto, and Dubai.
All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. A thriving design scene can yield big rewards for the cities that sell it best. Think of the kudos Paris gets for fashion or Milan garners for furniture design, not to mention the revenue each gathers from tourism and trade shows related to the industries.
Porto has had a tough time in the wake of the financial crisis, but thanks to the forward-thinking attitude of the mayor, Rui Moreira, among others, there's been a concerted effort to stop gentrification from stripping the city of its craft heritage, and it's finally paying dividends.
From graphic design to textiles, Porto seems well-placed for a much-deserved boost after years of turmoil and uncertainty, though issues remain in terms of how to sustain the field outside of tourism-led investment. Saima Tarek meets some of the key design figures in a Portuguese city where strong traditions are grappling with some very modern challenges.
Located on the western edge of the Douro Valley, Porto is an elderly riverside city that has arguably been overlooked in favour of the capital. Like Lisbon, low-cost flights have opened this humble and ancient city to the world. The attention that it's bringing is especially changing its design sectors. This weekend, there is a lot of commotion in the city's old customs house, as the annual Portugal Fashion Showcase, the biggest of its kind nationally, takes off. Supporting the manufacturing and design sides, it aims to fill the gaps that Portuguese footwear, clothing and textile firms have had to endure, even before the economic crisis. Designer Nuno Baltazar tells me more.
I think it's a more emotional way what defines Portuguese fashion. The universe of thinking of the designers, every time it's a little bit sad, you know? So it's what defines us. It's not a bad thing, but we don't have an image that defined Portuguese fashion yet. We have everything to be in a good way, but it's very important to have marriage the designers with the industry, because we have it all, but we are not matching together.
Nuno is trying to change that, along with Riopel, where he produced his latest collection. This factory is a half-hour drive from Porto, and is a key engine for the industry, developing high-technology fabrics, as well as producing garments for many international brands, including from France, Italy and Germany. Today, 98% of Riopel's output is exported. As an important part of Portugal's long textile-making history, the company is now finding ways to also work with and support homegrown designers.
At the same time, the mills change, but at the same time, the concept of fabrics change. In the past, the fabric have the cheap valor. Now, the fabrics have the big valor. The textile is the same important technology industry.
There is one important thing that we are doing that is concerning the human resource, that is a kind of workshop. And we have all the people from the mills that we joined, people from the spinning, from the weaving, from the finishing, from development, all together in one room. They understand how the mills, how is all the process, and they can improve even their own work.
Porto, as the heart of a heavily industrialised and austere region, has a long history of making, and not just port wine. From high-end leather shoes to concert posters, the design talent here should be a draw for such a small city. But it's also a poor city, meaning designers of all stripes have to make do with what they have. What they do have is a wide range of inspiration, from the chunky Arab wall tiles to Caesar's iconic tea house, and time-tested tools of the trade that can still be accessed for cheap. Communications and graphic designer Nuno Coelho explains more.
Now I know so many designers are going back into old ways of printing, for example, like many people now producing their things with letterpress workshop. For example, there's a whole new interest in that thing. Many people going after the vernacular design, like signs on the street. And I remember when I was still studying, like in the 90s, many designers or design students bought many magazines to know what was happening outside Portugal, trying to copy, I would say, that style. But now there's a whole generation that actually values what's it's unique here.
Downtown, behind a basic metal grey door, André Tavares works in a simple studio with a self-built elevated patio at the back. Formerly his parents' ground floor flat, this is where the curator of this year's Lisbon Architecture Triennale was born and raised. I ask him if he thinks Porto is a design city, whatever that implies.
Working as a publisher, I work a lot with designers, and I feel that there is an interest abroad from what is going on here, and I feel a great privilege of working here with so many nice people. What I see is that there is knowledge, there is capacity, there are technical infrastructures, wonderful printers, wonderful contractors for architecture that can allow you to produce things, and it's cheap. And I think that's why it's becoming so interesting for so many people, that you can do in Porto by half of the price that you do in Paris or London or Zurich or wherever. I think that's a very bad thing. Working conditions are not getting better. Actually, they are deteriorating. What I think generated this attention on design and fashion and other areas as a creative city is the tremendous but gigantic investment that the government made on tourism. We can wonder where we go without tourism. So it's tricky, this kind of attention, because of course we have access to things that we would not have if this attention was not set up. But at the same time, we have very hard conditions to work in comparison to other places.
From menswear to publishing, it's clear that Porto has a lot to offer on the design front. The key issue here is to not just rely on tourism, so the talent here can keep making. For Monocolino Porto, I'm Sai Matarik.
Next, we head to Mexico City to take the temperature of Central American design. Archivo Diseño y Arquitectura was founded in 2012 by architect Fernando Romero and his wife Suya Slim. It aims to foster discussion about design in Mexico City and the rest of the country, while providing an educational tool and source of inspiration for budding design students through its permanent collection of Mexican industrial design.
Monocle's New York bureau chief Ed Stocker was recently in Mexico City and caught up with director Mario Ballesteros at the archive's beautiful Modernist HQ, just a few metres from the former house of famed architect Luis Barragan.
We're on the first floor of Archivo, which is a design archive, so we're the only industrial design collection that's open to the public in Mexico. And up here, what we have is a small selection of our permanent collection. Basically, we have a selection of popular Mexican design. A big part of the collection is sort of trying to trace the history of industrial design in Mexico. So lots of it mixes a bit of traditional craft or popular anonymous design and the first bits of industrial design in Mexico. And we also have a series of classics from industrial design of the 20th and 21st centuries from abroad.
All right, well, let's have a look at some of the highlights for you, perhaps.
These are just a series of like traditional objects that have then inspired like newer versions by young designers, so we pair them up here. These are traditional lamps from the early 20th or even late 19th century, which are basically glass and metal. which you see everywhere in Mexico, but we also have some newer versions by designers. These are by Candela. So we have the molcajete, which is the traditional volcanic stone mortar, and then we have a newer version, which is sort of like terrazzo. This is a lot of what we try to do, sort of tracing the history of very like typical everyday objects that are present in everyone's home in Mexico, but that we don't really think about twice, usually. And this is something that we try to do here.
So the archivo, or archive, is really about educating Mexicans about industrial design?
Yeah, we wanted to be a resource, first of all, for design students and designers themselves, where they can really access sort of objects that are hard to find or not necessarily available in schools. So become a sort of object library, but also to introduce the general public that isn't necessarily interested in design into what the basics of industrial design are, or yeah, sort of a didactic introduction to the history of design in Mexico.
Are there new designers working in industrial design coming through at the moment?
There was a gap in industrial design in Mexico. Lots of industry shut down in the 70s and 80s just because Mexico started opening up to imports and all these things that you can find here, now you can find. So I think industrial design has really suffered in that sense. And production right now for younger designers is a lot more focused on like a smaller scale, even handmade craft. Lots of what you see in design in Mexico has this character. And it's really difficult to think of someone working at what we would normally think of as an industrial scale. So no, I would say it's hard to find designers that are working on objects such as the ones we have here.
Okay, well, not to be too pessimistic, it does seem that there are a lot of interesting designers coming through in Mexico at the moment, and they may not be on an industrial scale, but they're certainly producing interesting things. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think definitely it's an interesting moment for design in Mexico and Mexico City in particular. I think in a way we're jumping from this sort of traditional craft scale of work to a newer and more advanced sort of perspective, especially with the use of fabrication technologies and 3D printing and such. I think that designers here are now combining sort of traditional craft with these new technologies that are turning up interesting results.
It's interesting, though, that, you know, Monterrey used to be seen as the hub for all things design. And now a lot of firms, a lot of studios seem to be moving to Mexico City. So it seems like the sphere of influence or the kind of epicenter of design is shifting in Mexico.
Monterrey had lots of problems with violence that it hadn't had before. So really there was a big influx of people from all over the country coming into Mexico City. And also a number of people from abroad. We have people coming in from Spain, from Europe. You feel this dynamic sort of scene that we didn't have before.
That was Mario Ballesteros, director of Mexico City's Diseño y Arquitectura, talking to our New York bureau chief, that handsome devil, Ed Stocker.
Still to come, we take a look at Dubai's top-down efforts to cultivate a design scene in the desert and profile three products that show you don't need to be as big as a city to make great design happen.
The Foreign Desk is getting a little brother, the Foreign Desk Explainer. Each week we'll look at one of the world's biggest issues and, well, explain it. The Foreign Desk Explainer is a 5-minute nugget of information, analysis and opinion, and you can download it every week from iTunes, SoundCloud or, of course, Monocle.com. The Foreign Desk Explainer, available right now from Monocle 24.
Dubai is perhaps best known for commerce, oil and shining skyscrapers, more so perhaps than its native design scene. But a new initiative seeks to address that imbalance.
Set to open by late 2016, Dubai Design District, or D3, is an attempt on the part of the Emirati government to create a regional centre for creative design in the city.
We spoke to Mohammed Saeed Al-Sehi, the project's chief operating officer, to find out more about how the project hopes to elevate Dubai's status as a design city.
There is a lot of talent and a lot of creative people in the region. We have some business partners who moved in from the Kingdom of Saudi, from Lebanon. They say before we didn't have the opportunity or the platform to come and be based in a design district. So we have to travel to Europe or to America in order to be in a creative cluster and to fabricate our designs. So the talent, the creative mindset is there in the region. It's about creating the right ecosystem, the right infrastructure for them. And hopefully, as I said, we will have some of these startup designers to become some well-known brands at the regional and the global level. And Dubai and Dubai Design District, with its creative minds and creative talent that we have here, will be able to inspire the rest of the world, or to inspire the region, other than, you know, we are always inspired by top designers from different areas in the world. So we want that to change. We want to inspire people now through the creative people, the talented people we have in the district.
And Mohammed, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the specific mechanisms in place to help cultivate local design talent, either from Dubai or from the region. Do you work alongside the current design infrastructure and maybe universities to try to keep talent in the region?
Currently, we work on that through three different, basically, directions. The first one, the D3 direction, whereby we have special products designed for the startups. So basically, we subsidize a lot of whatever we are offering for them in order to give them a kickstart in the beginning. We have incubators. We give them access to knowledge. We give them access to fabrication facilities. And we give them access to investors as well and distributors. The second front, Dubai has launched Dubai Design and Fashion Council, which is basically an authority to put all the guidelines and the regulation for the design and fashion industry in Dubai and in United Arab Emirates. So basically, they have some mentorship programs, membership programs to mentor and to basically nurture the talent locally in Dubai. And we work very closely with them. So basically, when they refer a talent to us, we make sure we support them in D3. And the third front that we work on is basically we have an ambassador program where we have some sort of an ambassador in five countries, which are Saudi, Kuwait, Egypt, Lebanon, and Jordan. And the role of these ambassadors are to scout for talent for D3. So we approach them, we give them some very good offers to move to Dubai, to set up their business, and to give them the exposure that the designers should have.
Mohammed, obviously you're aware about how much thought and work has gone into establishing Dubai Design District, but a lot of people will take a look at the city and say most of the development and wealth has come into there in the last 50 years or so. There's no way that it's going to be able, in the time that it's been around, to build itself up in such a way to be able to compete with established design capitals like Milan, London, or New York, that you're just buying in culture. How would you respond to that?
The region lacks that point of design, and eventually Dubai will become that center of design here. Yes, we are a 44-year-old nation, but we took the best of all other international design centers, and we incorporated that in Dubai Design District, and the talent is there. The creative people are there. They are the most important factor in the success of Dubai Design District. If we manage to get all those talents, and we have already managed to get a good number of them, and we created the right ecosystem around them, then they will be able to produce, they will be able to inspire, and they'll be able to hopefully set trends that will go into the rest of the world.
That was Mohammed Saeed Al-Sahi, Chief Operating Officer of Dubai Design District. Josh, we've heard now from three different design hubs, so-called. Let's drill down on the foundational concept of this whole episode. What is the value of hub status for a city when it comes to design?
Well, I think we've had a bit of a doozy so far in uncovering what hub status means to different cities. I mean, this theme obviously becomes very prevalent before Salone, the big Milan furniture fair, when, you know, the great, the good, the undesirable and the unwashed descend on that northern Italian city to see what the latest happenings in the industry are. And that made me think, and I think we had a conversation where we both wondered, you know, what's the importance of it? I think it's a money game for most people. Can we get people coming here, spending their money, getting excited about designs here? But also, I think it's something that cities are increasingly awake to. I mean, we've seen a land grab from Chicago launching an architecture biennial. Later this year, we have Lisbon and Oslo doing the same thing. And I think a lot of cities want to kind of cash in on this. What do you think?
Obviously, design hub status is sexy, and I think the social capital is as important, the symbolic capital, as the cash capital that it can bring to a city. But, you know, I do wonder if there's a risk that as more and more cities kind of pile in to try to cultivate this status, that the status chasing is going to be prioritised above the design itself. And that could lead to a sequence of maybe a rash decisions and poor infrastructure investments that could actually stymie the scene that they're trying to cultivate. I'd be interested to hear about from you about Ireland's year of design. Was that last year or this year?
I think that's that was actually last year.
And it was actually very successful.
It's pretty successful. I mean, I thought you did a good job of examining Mohammed Said El Shehi's kind of motivations with regards to the Dubai Design District, because let's face it, that city, all of its infrastructure developments happened in the past 50 years, as you mentioned. You know, it does. It seems like a bit of a votive gesture at times to build, you know, just a centre where, you know, design is important. But I think he made some very good points. And I think Dubai is actually doing some quite good things for female designers. I think, you know, it's never been an outpost for craft. But perhaps with the combined weight of all of the different cultures in the region, it can become that. And something which, you know, local craftsmen, even the kind of Bedouin crafts of kind of weaving and making things, can find some life. So I think there is an element of people trying to buy in culture. There's an element of trying to foster something that is very, very nascent in the region. But I think it's probably a good thing. And the reason that that relates to Ireland is there was a seminal report. A bunch of Swedes, I believe, went over to Ireland. The people, not the vegetables. They went over to Ireland and they said, look, we're getting a lot of traction from our design heritage, the furniture that we make here. You guys should be doing more. That was 50 years ago. It's taken them that long to launch an Irish Design Week. And people are starting to take notice. Amazing shops like Makers and Brothers are showing off local craft. You know, there's people blowing glass. There's people making rattan baskets. There's also furniture designers. And I just think that the next item we have, you discuss with Chiara Rimella, one of our researchers here, villages that have been able to create that design hub status. And actually, I don't think it's as complicated as buying in all of the infrastructure, spending a lot of money. You've just got to make something well and then PR it enough for people to take notice. What do you think about that, Henry?
I think it's critical to note that when it comes to cultivating a design hub, the main resource for any given location is in the population and the skill set of the population rather than any physical resource or physical infrastructure per se. And so, yeah, Chiara joined me in the studio to talk through three products created from smaller conurbations, towns or villages, where for one reason or another there is a particular skill set among the population or a particular tradition of craftsmanship and design which enables them to compete and be a player on the world design scene despite being very small. So here's Chiara now.
So I'd like to start with a company called B&B Italia. The company is a huge giant in the international furniture market. And yet it's based in a city called, in a town, a village actually, let's bring it all down to the small scale, in a village called Novedrate, a population around 2,900. And I think it's interesting to talk about B&B Italia because, like many of other Italian furniture giants, many of them are based in this range of villages around Milan, just about kind of 40 minutes away, an hour away. But despite kind of creating really Milan's name and the design scene that Milan has grown to have, most of the companies that we will see at Salone are actually based in these tiny villages. And despite having created this huge empire for themselves, many of them decide still to keep their headquarters in their original villages where they were born, sometimes out of tiny, tiny little workshops.
So what kind of stuff do they make, Chiara? Have you got an example of anything?
I'd like to refer to their newest release, which is the Richard Sofa by Antonio Citterio. Antonio Citterio is a designer who was born in Meda, which again is another town a little bigger than Novedrate, but again, a small town in this area. So you can see it's very local. It's all concentrated around this area. And the sofa is an expansive, kind of flexible and composable, upholstered set of units.
Is it modular? Can you move it around? Is that
what? That's right.
Okay, got it.
Indeed, a modular one. You can compose it as well as you want. And it's made of 76 elements. So just go crazy with it.
Where are we going to go next, Chiara?
So next, I'd like to go to Finland. I'd like to talk about Finland because it's so often associated with glass and glass blowing. And, you know, obviously, Itala has made it famous design-wise. But there is a tiny, tiny little village called Nuttajärvi. So Nuttajärvi is known as the glass village because it houses the oldest glass-blowing factory in Finland. And there's a particular company which I'd like to talk about, which is Nunu Design. The designer Anu Pentinen has travelled to Australia, has lived in Helsinki, and that's where she founded the brand originally in 2003, but then she relocated to Nuttajärvi, and that's where she has her studio now. And interestingly enough, you know, so many times you hear of people relocating to the countryside and they go like, I want to be inspired by nature and I want to connect with nature, which is all very good and well. But actually, Anu, when she refers to her own work, says that living in a countryside just allows her the space to kind of breathe and work properly. But her inspiration still comes from the urban landscape.
Can you describe some of the stuff she makes? I can see some in front of you there.
Yes, so I'd like to refer to the planes vessels.
Plane, is that P-L-A-N-E-S? Just so people know.
That's right.
Okay, brilliant.
So these are extremely colourful, ribbed vases in very playful shapes. And I just think they're such a beautiful thing, and one that, you know, we tend to think of products produced in villages are like chintzy and sometimes perhaps a little kitsch, kind of traditional things. But these are at the forefront of design, you know. So really, it's just in the mind of the creator and in the skill of the maker.
And finally, Chiara, we have one more choice, I believe.
Yes, we do. So we're heading to Germany next to pay a visit to the headquarters of Duravit, which is, again, a huge company of bathroom kind of accessories and fittings. They are based in Hornburg in a very idyllic setting by a river in the midst of vegetation, and it's just a beautiful thing. I think here the interesting thing to draw upon is the fact that they've decided to stick to this location because it was so instrumental to their creation in the first place. You know, when you make ceramics, it really matters where you are. It really matters where you can get your materials from. And this headquarters was right by water, it was right by clay, it was right by all the elements that were fundamental to the perfect running of a ceramics company and of a kiln. And so Duravit has stuck to this location. And to date, they still design everything there and stay true to their roots, I guess.
And give me an example of some of the products that they make. What are they designing at the moment?
So here I've brought to kind of reference this line designed by Norman Foster. It's called Bathroom_Foster. And this is a series that draws on circular shapes and kind of evokes the act of cupping your hands to drink water from your hands. And this is a series of basins, wash basins and toilet seats and that kind of thing. It's just so brilliant to be able to combine the most cutting edge kind of creatives and draw them in and never really betray where you've come from.
Monocle design researcher Chiara Rumilla there, taking me through three products that are the fruit of design in towns and villages.
And sadly, that's all for this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, sat right opposite me, big grin on his face, Henry Rees Sheridan.
If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to email me. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. We're back next week at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes.
Don't forget, you can also leave us reviews on all of these platforms and tell us what we're doing that you like and what you cannot stand. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Bennett.
And I'm Henry Rees Sheridan.
And until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.